Spend the afternoon with us on the Insider Mind podcast with Dr. Mark Rackley. We got into Canary Wharf in the morning, caught up with the boys over a coffee and ran through the script. Saw we were in 51 countries now. Thank you so much for the support. Dr. Mark and I, we took him through to the studio, got the lights, cameras and ATEM all set up and put the finishing touches on. Then we ran through these four key areas on the podcast for an hour with Dr. Mark. Took a couple photos. This was one of our favourite episodes and we hope you enjoy. Woo! Dr. Mark, thank you so much for coming back on.
Yay! Thank you for having me.
How's everything been going? You've been absolutely killing it, it looks like.
Yeah, busy. I think it's always busy in mental health, hey? Like, you're busy in the clinic because you're looking after your patients, and then I'm trying to do more stuff like this where I'm promoting mental health and I'm talking about it and I'm trying to raise awareness. So, yeah, it's been great, yeah? A couple of podcasts, doing my own podcast. I need to clone myself.
For sure, you've been very busy. For those who didn't listen to episode 10, I think it was, this has gone really quickly that time, with yourself, can you explain a bit about you and a bit about your story?
Yeah, so I'm Irish, obviously. I'm not putting this accent on. I'm from Dublin. I did all my training over there as a psych, and I'm in London 15 years now. I spent 7 of those years in the NHS working as a psychologist. The last years from then, I have my own clinic in Putney where I treat adolescents and adults, all areas of mental health. So all the usual stuff you'd imagine a psychologist treats, I treat. So depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, eating disorders, ADHD, autism. So I look after my patients in my clinic, and then I have my own podcast and I do this stuff with you guys. So it's great. I feel like it's kind of evolved quite nicely.
Yeah.
Where I like the fact I'm taking my work outside my clinic, because the reason I did that is because the need is so big. The need is massive. And even to see, like, obviously the waiting lists in the NHS are huge. And even privately, like, you don't get seen immediately. So I just felt like if I could do something alongside my clinical work where you could kind of have doctors talking about mental health and giving the public access to, okay, it might not be kind of treatment, but at least there's a conversation about mental health that they can listen to, which might just help to hold them or to trigger them to get some help. So,
Agree. Yeah. Is the waiting list gone up anymore? Or, you know, on the ADHD one alone, has that gone up in the NHS? Yeah. Because the last time we spoke, you said it was 5 years or something.
It's big. So if you want an ADHD assessment, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Literally, good luck with that. Like, that just, like, that is massive on the NHS. Yeah. And even privately, like some of the private clinics, you're looking at even 3 to 6 months to, if you want to go and pay for it. So the problem is that the need is so high. It's massive. And there isn't enough doctors to meet that need, unfortunately. So nobody, I hate having patients waiting for treatment. But it's kind of inevitable, unfortunately, because we just don't have the supply to meet the demand.
My knowledge of ADHD isn't anywhere as much as yours, and clearly as much as yours either. Are we in danger of also overthinking the whole ADHD thing and almost over-diagnosing people before they're being diagnosed?
We talked about this the other day.
We mentioned it briefly on our first episode together, and I don't know how you can distinguish that, because I think you mentioned there are like 500 separate symptoms individually. And are we perhaps in danger of sort of looking like someone like Tom and thinking it's the new sexy thing to be called ADHD, therefore I must be it, therefore let's queue up and wait? And then what do you do with that?
It's a great question, Joe. I mean, often hear people say, oh, I think I'm a little bit ADHD. I'm like, well,
what does that even mean?
What is that? Like, you're either right or you aren't, you know?
Yeah.
And I agree, like, I think to diagnose it, it's actually quite simple to diagnose it. And I don't mean that to say it's a simple disorder. It's not. But if you're working in the ADHD space, you can you can pick it up very quickly, very, very quickly. And with ADHD, the patient's life is the D part. It's disordered. So their life is impaired because they have ADHD. And the impairment can be massive. Mm. So with some of the patients I have, like the kids aren't going to school anymore. They're not sleeping properly. There's additional maybe mental health problems like depression, anxiety. And then with my adult patients, their life will be very chaotic. So with cases like that, then absolutely, like that's a very kind of black and white case of ADHD, which needs help. But another case, because it's like anything, it's on a spectrum. Mm. Somebody might think, well, I'm a bit kind of hyperactive or I'm a bit disorganized. Okay. But that doesn't mean you have ADHD.
Sure. Yeah.
Like it's not that. And I often think as well, it's quite disrespectful to people who have got ADHD to say like, well, I think I have that. Well, no, you don't, because with the greatest of respect, your life is too functional.
Mm. Right.
So I agree. I think, there's a lot of talk around it, but actually on a kind of clinical level, when it's there, then it's very clear, but also it needs treatment because the person's life is impaired as a result of that. Yeah.
Should I say what I find really interesting? You did a talk on the ADHD club.
That's right. So thank you for coming. Pleasure. I really enjoyed that. Yeah.
What I find really interesting in our sort of ADHD community is everyone in there has been diagnosed with ADHD, but everyone's really different as well, which I find really interesting because I don't know why I assumed when I went onto the group, it would all be, 30 me's, and it's just like not. And I don't know why, but that like caught me really off guard, and it's showing like, it, in my opinion, you can misread people. There's people on the group where I'd be like, do you have ADHD? And then you see a different side to them and you're like, oh, absolutely. Like I can see that now. Mm. But it's funny. And I think that makes it harder for people as well, because it's easy to put these reels out on Instagram being, as we talked about before, saying, you're struggling to sleep or you're struggling to focus. You have ADHD. But like you said, 500 plus symptoms, everyone's different. And I think that's going to make it really hard as well. Mm. Because everyone's different, this is the bit that I always find a bit tricky. Is that not hard to diagnose if it's just the same diagnosis side, but then I have people in the group who I would think are complete polar opposites to me? Mm. How does that work with just one system of diagnosing people?
I find, that's a great question. Sometimes it's really clear, like you'll have the patient in your office and they're literally like, there's no eye contact. They're off on crazy tangents. They're like, I have a sofa like that in my office and they're all over the sofa and the cushions are everywhere. And I'm literally like chasing them metaphorically around the room. I think, okay, well, there's a massive problem here.
Like, yeah.
Because it's, and then they're telling you about their life and you can kind of see their life is really chaotic. But with other patients, like they'll be like, you won't see any of that. And even their life might be really, really good, really good. But what you'll pick up on is the fact that they have the inattentive type. And so the inattentive type is that they lose their focus, or they have like the crazy RSD, or they really struggle with the emotional regulation. But with those, it's not so obvious. But when you talk to them, and particularly when you get into areas like relationships, and what are your relationships like? And what's your emotion regulation like? And when you get into those conversations, then you start to say, oh, okay, I think there's, and they'll when you give them the feedback, they're like, I think this might be like ADHD. Mm. If they don't know much about it, they sometimes can be quite shocked and think, well, I didn't think I had that. But then when you explain it, because again, you're born with it. And then when you explain the pattern that you're seeing over the course of their life, it makes sense. Yeah. It literally falls into place. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just love talking about it. So sorry, Jack. Yeah. One thing I always find is like, I get a lot of people say to me, oh, I wouldn't know you had ADHD. You mask it really well. Mm. I'm really good at stuff. I think now you guys know me, Siobhan behind the camera, Joe co-hosting, you're like, oh, it's really obvious.
Yeah.
But like at the start, I feel like I'm very good at masking it. And like if I meet someone for the first time or say if I'm in a meeting or meeting with a client, I can mask that. Is that a common thing you find?
Oh, totally. So again, I love these conversations because it's great to pick it apart. Absolutely, but the masking comes at a massive price because when you're, and you'll know this, Tom, when you're masking, you're using up all that energy and then you're going to have to crash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
And then it always, the crash always comes because you're using up so much energy to try and mask and to try and manage that situation. But then like your social battery dies and I imagine you probably just need lots of time on your own.
Yep, just on my own.
Yeah.
Or just like even, I know it sounds so silly and this might be something else as well, but I'll try and wake up in the morning and I'll literally feel like I'm going to faint. I'm so tired from masking the day before, whether it's like a 3-hour meeting where, you know, the conversation's almost going off in my head. And I'm trying to focus on not talking about this or not interrupting and then also focus on the meeting. Mm. I get home, I don't even want to speak to anyone. And I find that really hard because that can damage relationships as well. Like my girlfriend will come home from her work and be like, hey, and I'll just be like exhausted. Mm. And I just won't want to speak to anyone. Mm. So nothing to do with anyone. Mm. But I think I wanted to ask that because I'm finding that a lot at the moment in particular is the more meetings I have or the more work I'm doing, I'm masking more and more and more. Mm. And not because I'm embarrassed, but I'm very aware, self-aware of what other people think of me. And I'm very self-conscious of that. So I don't know if I'm doing it more at the moment, but I just feel exhausted.
Just think how much pressure and demand you're putting on your brain.
Yeah.
Like it's like your brain is literally fizzing with all the stuff that it's trying to manage when you're doing that. Which of course is a massive ask. Mm. It's a massive ask because you only have limited energy to at any given point. And then when the energy runs out, then you need to replenish. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that Tom mentioned just then, and I want to touch on what you mentioned earlier about school.
Yeah.
Because for me, I struggled to concentrate in school because for whatever reason I did, not because I've ADHD, but I struggled with other things as well. And I think back and I think how hard it must be to be in a school environment that doesn't provide those things for you and how sort of archaic the whole school system is. I wonder whether you see schools changing to compensate for the amount of kids that are coming out with ADHD and they just can't concentrate in classes. No, you just don't think what needs to change? Because I think we're failing all the kids that go to school and like me. Again, separately, I felt like I was really stupid at school because I just couldn't concentrate. The information never went in. Mm. And I had this 20 years certain, well, not since school, but since I left school, I'm now thinking that I will always fail when it comes to exams. I just didn't find a way that worked best for me at the school, and the school has never provided that for me.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, I guess you answered the question already by saying no. So I guess what, if the schools aren't doing anything, what can they do better and how do you implement, how do you implement change?
Oh, we could do a whole episode on this. Because I literally deal with this every week.
Yeah, I'm
every single week. Literally, I deal with this. I wrote a whopper of a letter last week to one school about my patient. The problem with the schools is when you have a set curriculum and a setup in terms of how this is how we teach, then it is there to provide that for the majority because the majority can actually work with that. But if you're in the minority where you have ADHD or say autism, then that system isn't set up for you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to accommodate into the system. The system is not going to accommodate you.
Square peg for our house. Yeah.
And that's the biggest problem. That is the biggest problem because you, like, with some of my patients, like they will talk in class. Their mind, they'll zone out. They will talk back. And it's not because they're bad kids. They're not bad kids. It's the fact that they've got ADHD and this is what is happening in their brain. And they're massively trying to manage that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, the schools, like I go down to the finest detail in my letters where I say, all the teachers that teach this kid need to be mindful of how they speak to the child.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the rejection sensitivity, like they're going to be hugely anxious anyway around the sensitivity piece of I'm not good enough. So like you can't come down the heavy on these kids because you'll break them.
Mm-hmm.
like you and you know, that means for some teachers, like you know, can't change people's personalities. But when you're in the room, you got to be different because you've got to accommodate for these. So it's a mixed bag, Joe, with that one. Some schools are great and they take on board everything you say and they really work very hard to accommodate that. And some schools are like only for the fact it's illegal, if they could kick all those kids out of the school,
they would. Yeah.
I find that I think looking back at it, we've talked about school quite a lot, Joe and I, and I think the structure side of it probably helped me massively and mastered it. That's my only thing where I'm like, I think the structure side helped me with my ADHD, but just the overall, I was the kid who always answered back or snapped back or was like, why is the teacher talking to me like this? I'm not just going to sit here and just let this happen when everyone else would be like, okay, sorry. I'd be like, no,
yeah,
I'm not sorry. Yeah, I'd be like, well, you can't talk to me like that. And that was always me. And that makes a lot of sense about the
But that's your sensitivity to injustice.
Exactly.
Because you'll have that massive insensitivity. So if there's something wrong, your sensitivity to injustice, you're gonna defend yourself, and you'll defend the other kids in the class as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I still do that now with people. I always defend other people, and if something's wrong, you'll probably never see me just let it slide. That's one of my things where, you know, can get me in a lot of trouble, but also it's like something I pride myself on is I always pick, you know, what's best, if that makes sense. Like if I see something wrong, if I see someone being bullied, I have zero problem. Calling it out to that person, and it's been on the back end of a few bad things a few times, but from that, it's something I'm actually, that's one of my favorite things, it sounds silly, but favorite things about myself, that I have the courage to do that sometimes, because people need that. I think a lot of people in those situations I found at school, if they were getting bullied or whatever, they felt so alone, they felt like they didn't have a voice, or just in today's day and world with work and things like that, it's just a lot of people don't have that in them to fight back. And if that's something I've always respected, if I saw people do that or just sticking up, even if it's sticking up to their friends, I find that a very admirable thing. I feel like that could be something that's getting less and less. I might be wrong in these generations coming through, but that's always something that makes a lot of sense with the ADHD side, but that's always something I've noticed.
Injustice is like, zero tolerance, zero tolerance.
I wanted
they don't care who it is.
I wanted to touch on next was sad.
Yes,
and this is something I get quite affected by. Sad. I know a few of the boys in the room do as well. It's a really interesting topic. Obviously, something that's quite big at the moment as well. In ADHD, I feel like I feel things, you know, quite heavily as well. Myself. With sad and going through things, I don't know if that's a link, but that was kind of the link I wanted to draw to. Is that something you see more in ADHD individuals getting sad, or is it kind of no correlation?
There's a massive correlation.
Is there?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So the rates are about 50%.
Really?
Yeah, they're that high.
Wow. Okay.
That people with ADHD will also get SAD symptoms as well. So it's huge. Yeah.
It's massive.
Is that just being sensitive to certain things, or just hypersensitivity to sort of the stimulus around them, or?
Well, the thing with SAD, it's the obviously it's to do with the changing of the seasons and the lack of light, and so there's a couple of reasons why people with ADHD would be kind of more kind of prone to SAD. So one of the things with and you'll know this, Tom, is with ADHD, there can be a lot of delayed sleep where you want to go to bed, you want to sleep, not in every case, but where you're sleeping later, because when it's kind of downtime and the brain is understimulated, instead of it drifting off, it goes looking for stimulation, so it can wake up. And that's so therefore you're going to bed later because your brain just won't wind down, or you're overthinking, or you know, that ability just to be able to kind of drift off just doesn't happen.
Okay.
So you're staying awake later. Now, one of the things with SAD is because it's affected by light, which is the big issue, of course, in this country, because we get such little light in the wintertime. One of the hypotheses around it is our sleep hormone is melatonin, mm-hmm. and melatonin is released at the later part of the day, which is why we get drowsy, because it gets darker, and then the brain, because it's got the circadian rhythm, which is your sleep cycle, the brain goes, oh, it's time to sleep now. So we get the serotonin dumped in. So what we think happens with SAD is because we get less light, we're getting the serotonin earlier.
Right.
That makes sense.
And the brain goes, oh, it's bedtime. No, it's like 6 o'clock. But because it's dark.
Yeah.
So we're kind of getting drowsier. We're tired. We kind of want to go to bed. But actually, it's not that we're actually tired. So it's the fact is that we're inside. We're not outside. We don't have as much light. And so therefore, then we're having more melatonin.
Right.
And so what that can lead to then is that we're sleeping more. And some people will be more sensitive to that. So say, coming back to what I was talking about with ADHD, if you have somebody who is already struggling to sleep, and then we have the lack of light, and then they're going to bed later because of the problem with the ADHD, then the combination of the SAD and the ADHD can be problematic.
Right.
That's me right now.
Yeah. Am I right then assuming that if you, let's say with ADHD as an example, is there a direct correlation between ADHD and depression?
It does correlate, Joe. The bigger one with ADHD, again, just kind of from my, is it's anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's more anxiety because there's a lot of overthinking. There's a lot of, again, with the rejection sensitivity dysphoria, it's the, you know, it's the overthinking around, do they like me? Like, what did that look mean? Why haven't they got back to me? So it's all of that stuff, which then feeds insecurity and anxiety.
Okay.
But it can absolutely be correlated with depression. Fine. As well. Yeah.
I read an article the other day from the Times, and they said that 2% of the population in the UK will struggle from severe cases of seasonal affective disorder.
Yeah.
20% will suffer from milder cases.
Mm-hmm.
You just said then around 50% of people with ADHD suffer with SAD, which is a huge correlation. If it's 2% are severe, 20% are milder, and 50% of people with ADHD will get it. That's a pretty crazy correlation to have. Actually, quite scary.
It is. It's massive because, again, just because think about it, like, you're dealing with an ADHD wired brain.
Yeah.
One of the things we know with ADHD, and you'll know this, Tom, is people with ADHD are very sensitive to environments, and massively, they're sensitive to change.
Massively.
You think, well, like winter, massive change. Like, you can't change the environment. You can't, put the lights on. You know, it's when you walk outside, when you're outside, then you are reacting to that environment. And also, the other part of it too is because we spend more time inside than people with ADHD, of course, the lack of stimulation, because they're not able to get outside as much or do certain things, then that massively affects them as well.
It feels like there's a vicious cycle.
It is a vicious
constantly
cycle.
Vicious cycle. But you know it's coming.
Yeah.
I knew this was coming, but how do I stop it? Yeah. I'm sure people listening are probably thinking the same thing. What advice would you give them?
Yeah.
How do you can't stop it, but how do you minimize the effects of this?
You got to plan for it, Tom. Like, if you know you're sensitive to SAD, then you got to plan for it, because the winter's predictable. You know it's going to be rubbish. So you can't just wing it, because it could possibly become more problematic for you in terms of really starting to affect your mood. So I often say to my patients, right, what are we going to do about this in terms of what's the winter going to look like for you? So we look at things like keeping a routine around sleep. So even though you might want to go to bed at 7 o'clock, no, that's not happening. So you have a routine of like bed at this time, waking up at this time. And then in the morning time, especially, because that can be the time when it's really hard to get out of bed, or you're kind of thinking, I don't want to face the day, that we have a structure in the morning around, okay, what, you're going to shower, you're going to do this at breakfast time. And then within the day, getting outside. So even if, unless the weather's absolutely horrendous, but get outside. Because if you're going to stay inside, then that's not actually going to help you. Mm. In fact, that could be the very environment that will make you feel worse. So getting outside, like walk the dog, you know, go and meet your friends for coffee, get off the tube two stops earlier, but get outside, get active.
Mm.
So that you are in an environment where it's going to stimulate you, but also you're going to get exposure to light. One of the other things we also talk about is how you're going to spend the winter. So spending the winter, not just sat on your sofa in front of the television.
Yeah.
But like, because that will not be good for you. Again, that will drop your mood.
With the Christmas films, though, that's hard to do. That's hard to do. Netflix have already released them. I was like, last night, let me take a look.
A little bit of that. I'm not knocking that. Like, but again, if you, it's too passive, that.
It is.
And especially like with people with ADHD, that's going to just mangle their brains.
Yeah.
That won't help. So I think, do you want to learn a language? Do you want to learn an instrument? Do you want to learn whatever? Take up knitting or whatever. So you've got like a project that you're running through the holidays or the winter time as well.
Mm.
And staying social. So get outside, see your friends, have them over, and make your home super cozy. So make the environment in your home really nice.
Makes sense.
Because we are all very sensitive to environments. We like nice environments. They make us feel nice.
Mm-hmm.
So make your home cozy.
Yeah. Do you still run in the winter?
Yeah.
You do, all year round?
Yeah.
No matter what? Because that's how you regulate your mental health, isn't
totally,
it?
Totally, yeah. If you literally can't feel my fingers off some of them. I'm trying to record my videos. Am I?
I wanted to ask you, if let's say hypothetically you couldn't run.
Yeah.
Injury, illness.
I had that recently. Like, okay. I had an injury. Yeah.
How are you then, personally?
I went for a walk instead.
Okay, great. That's good. Yeah.
Enjoy that. You know, I can either say I couldn't run, but I could walk on my. I had a calf strain.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, and I saw my physio, and I thought, I think I can walk this. So I basically walked my run.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Absolutely.
And it was great.
Yeah,
it was really good. It was interesting doing that because normally I'm kind of whizzing past and my brain's kind of
take more in
stuff. Actually stopped and I never, like, I ran in Richmond Park and I never stopped and take pictures of the deers, but I did.
That's great.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Really different experience. Yeah,
that's cool.
It was nice.
I like that.
I'd be really curious to know, you help people all day, every day with their mental health and with disorders such as ADHD. Things such as SAD. Do you ever struggle yourself with areas such as seasonal affective disorder? And if you do, knowing what you know, is that a benefit or do you still struggle anyway? Yeah. If you do,
it's when I don't struggle with SAD. I think because I grew up in Dublin, like bad weather was just like
the normal.
That was my life, you know, for how many years I lived there. So. That never affected me as such, where the light would bother me or where I'd kind of struggle in the winter time. But I try and walk the walk and talk the talk. Like, I'm saying something to my patient, I do try and live it as well. Because if I can stand over it because I'm doing it myself, then I feel it just gives me more kind of credibility.
Absolutely.
To be able to say, listen, I know this is maybe a little bit out there, or you might, you know, find this a little bit weird, but why don't we try this? And so I will bring those conversations in. Like, I will talk about things like, you know, how about we try some kind of guided meditation, or what about if you get outside and you just kind of observe your surroundings, or like try something different. So I do try and absolutely, like, again, because I know the stuff that works for me, then like I will bring that in and speak to my patients about, like, listen, why don't we kind of try this and see what you think.
In a roundabout way, I want to link this back to sort of Men's Mental Health Month, which is what we're in right now. I wanted to ask you if women or men, probably the answer is already, respond better to those kind of advice bits and saying, go away, try this, go away, try that. Do you think men or women respond better, worse, or indifferent?
I think it's more down to the personality, Joe, really. Like, some guys are great. like they'll be like, they'll take it all on board and go, yeah, they're brilliant. And then some of them are a bit more resistant because they think, well, that sounds a bit strange, you know, especially when you mentioned kind of meditation and mindfulness. They're like,
what's that?
Am I going to sit in a Buddhist temple? You're not. But like, it's because they don't understand it, you know? And I suppose about with some of the women, I feel, you probably, women are a bit more so open to that stuff. Because I think there's a sense, well, they don't see it as more of a gender-based thing. Mm-hmm. They just see it kind of as a thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas with men, sometimes it's like, well, you know, well, men don't do that. Well, they kind of do, actually. But you're just not that man that isn't doing it. You know, men do this stuff. Like, so I think, you know, sometimes it's that kind of more gender stereotypes with blokes where they're a little bit more maybe resistant because they don't see that as that's what men do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you spot any sort of trends in men's mental health going through in December? Is there anything that you've gone, oh, that's come up a lot around this time, because this will be released in December? It's November, at the end of November at the moment, coming into this time, and then I think after Christmas as well, that sort of January blues going through January, late January. Is there any sort of things you spot in particular, like regular trends in a way? Trends might be the wrong word, but when people come into the clinic,
is there
anything in particular you see?
Too much drinking every year.
Really?
More in men.
The alcohol intake.
Christmas time's hard for that.
Totally. Like where obviously there's a lot of socializing, there's a lot of stuff going on. And
silly season, they call it, isn't it now?
And it's not good. Like, it's like, I drink alcohol, but like, I'm not knocking that by any means, but there can be almost like a pass on it, which is, well, like, it's okay to kind of consume more or to be like to be drinking more regularly. And for some people, like, that's really not going to help their mental health, because they will struggle kind of to manage their mental health because they're drinking too much. But also if they're coping with any kind of trauma or any kind of difficulty in their life, if you're drinking on that, or if you're drinking on your ADHD meds or your antidepressants, then that can become hugely problematic.
Drinking's a funny one, because obviously it's a hard time, because I think at Christmas as well, it's quite just a common and easy gift to get someone like a bottle of wine or, you know, some beers to your mates, or I'll buy you a drink down the pub, it's Christmas, let's go have a good time. But that, let me go buy you a drink down the pub, it's Christmas, comes from about five or six different people. So then you have six different pub trips, and then you have seven or eight bottles of wine, and then all this adds up. And I find it really interesting. I've really looked into alcohol a lot, because I'm not someone who drinks a lot. But I really like to drink. It's my funny thing. Like, I actually enjoy drinking. I like the taste of it. I like, you know, if I have a wine, it's like, oh, where's the wine from? Like, I really enjoy that. But it screws with me. It absolutely screws with me. Like, it won't be a hangover for 3 hours. It'll be a hangover for 3 days. It'll be emotionally, I'll be up and down. So now I'm at that point where I'm kind of more self-aware that I'm either a one pint or 100 pint on evenings type guy. It's just being more self-aware of that's an interesting side, especially at Christmas, because you don't want to feel left out when everyone's drinking. You also know yourself, and you know your limits as well, and it's not going to do you good. So I'm actually not surprised a lot of people come in from that drinking side of being like, massively overdrank. My mental health's in the worst place. And I find it hard. I don't know. I'm sure there's a way around it of just being like, I'm not drinking. But when you're in environments where everyone's drinking, you almost feel like an anomaly. And then I get that sense of, this might just be me personally, you might feel the same of, oh, like, are they going to think I'm like different? Are they going to think I have a problem? Because there's that misconception a lot of the time is, if you don't drink, it doesn't mean there's a problem. You just might not want to drink. That's what Fraser said the other day on the podcast. And every time I don't drink, my friend's like, you okay? Like, what's wrong? And I'm like, there's actually nothing wrong. But from there, I get in my own head and it gets worse. And I'm like, oh, I'll just have a drink. Like, just stop asking me questions. Is that something you find quite a lot as well? Like that questioning behind it?
Yeah, for sure.
Feeling left out.
Particularly if there's a, because funny, because we're in Canary Wharf. But like, if you were to look at the lifestyle of some of the people around here, It's almost the expectation
to booze
that
yeah.
you will go on boozy lunches, that the boozy lunches will turn into boozy dinners, and then you'll end up in the West End and some kind of club. Mm-hmm. And so you're it's almost like it's the culture, and culture is a really powerful thing because it's got a massive effect on all of us, whether we like it or not. And to kind of stand outside of that culture, particularly if it's your work colleagues or your family or your mates, like that's not easy.
No, it's
that
not.
That isn't easy. It's tough. Yeah, it's really tough. And it takes a lot of mental resilience to do that, because, of course, you know, not everybody will respect your decision. In fact, you can, because I hear it with my patients, is, you know, they get ridiculed for wanting to pace themselves and not wanting to go absolutely nuts. And then if the alcohol then leads into drug taking later on in the night, then again, it's the expectation, well, that's what we do. And if you're trying to kind of be a bit more mindful of your mental health, or if you're thinking about, you know, the future version of you, like what's tomorrow Mark going to look like, then that's, nobody's thinking like that.
Yep.
Nobody's thinking of what's the version of me tomorrow going to look like. So it's not easy. It really isn't easy. And it can be a very difficult place to actually stay consistent in that.
How do, I'm not speaking from my point of view, and although I have been in situations where I wanted to approach, because I don't drink really, how would one, let's say, go about approaching their male friends if they're concerned about their behavior, if they've seen them acting out of character or drinking way more, or the drugs and that kind of, because I'm around that environment a lot more than, say, most people, being from rugby, and I know you can attest to that as well.
Yeah,
massively.
How does a guy approach a guy and express concern
in like a non-threatening way?
Or forcing or therapy on them. How would I, Tom, Siobhan, yourself, how would one go about a conversation where it involves expressing concern but not pushing them in a direction of, say, therapy?
So first of all, you need to set that up very well. So that can't be I'm in the moment and I'm going to say it, and that needs to be really considered, because you might only get one shot to do this, and you don't want to blow your one shot. So you want to give it the best chance of landing and being effective as you can. So I often encourage my patients, because we do have these conversations, is don't do this over the telephone. Don't do this over messaging. Actually be in a space with the person, like be physically present with them, and set it up so go for a walk with them, or like go for dinner or whatever, but have a setup where it's conducive to you actually being able to speak to the person privately, but also that it's not going to be something where it's going to be kind of a crazy environment where you can't hear each other. The next bit is the most important bit, which is you need to use I statements, not you statements.
Okay.
Because you statements feel like you're attacking the person, and the chances are you're going to get a defensive response. So I'm concerned. As your friend, I am worried. So you're owning your perspective, but you're saying how you feel. And of course, the other person can say, well, you can't feel like that, because they can try and invalidate your feelings, but you can't invalidate somebody's feelings because that's their experience. So if you're saying, you know, I feel worried, I feel concerned, then the other person says, you've got nothing to worry about. But then if you back it up and say then why you're feeling concerned. Right. So, you know, on this night out, I kind of noticed that maybe you weren't in a good place, or, you know, I was concerned you were a bit more out of control. And I've noticed there's a kind of a pattern here, and I'm worried about that. And because I'm worried about it, then that's why I want to talk to you about it. So the person might get defensive, but they can't argue with what you're doing, and they can't argue with what you're saying.
That's such a even just saying it then, it just felt unthreatening when you were talking about it. That's such an interesting way of doing it, because I feel like I've messed a lot of conversations up.
Oh, we've all done that.
Yeah. Now, like you say something like that, it seems so obvious, but until someone points it out, that's not, that doesn't feel like an obvious thing to take. You're not almost taking the blame. It feels like you're like, I see this, you know. And it's just, it's such an interesting way of doing it. It's actually one of the best things I've heard.
And you just keep it really gentle, like you just keep your, you know, you keep it, you're really safe, and what you're saying to your mate is, like, this is a safe space, and you're opening the door for them to walk in, but even if they choose not to walk in, they know, well, that space wasn't threatening, that space wasn't attacking me. Mm-hmm. And so even if it doesn't land in the moment you do it, like, it's going to land.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Really,
I feel like there's a lot of men who I speak to regularly who have messaged Tom and I in particular, and it's just that's how the conversation starts. And I think that's where a lot of men really battle, is just how you actually approach those kind of conversations. Yeah. And I think a lot of men, and women in particular as well, whose partners, husbands, boyfriend, whatever might be struggling, is how they best go about starting those conversations. And I can't thank you enough for that. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It really got me thinking. Yeah. I almost didn't know what to say afterwards, because I was like going back to situations where I was like, damn, I should have said that then, or like that could have been such a thing. Absolutely going to use that from now on. I wanted to touch on Christmas too as a whole. This is coming out around Christmas time. Obviously, it's just a very great time of year for a lot of people, but also a very tough time for a lot of people. On the other hand, you've got things such as financial stress, family problems, a whole range of things. And I saw on the Mental Health UK studies that 3 in 10 Brits report a decline in their mental health over the Christmas period, 30%. And what seems like such an amazing thing for a lot of people is probably one of the worst times of the year. I just wanted to talk about men's mental health as a whole at Christmas. You know, if there's any advice that you'd give around that. We talked about drinking. I'd like to talk a bit about the financial side of things. I know it's a very, you know, hard situation for a lot of people in the UK right now, or wherever you are listening to this. I'm sure you feel the same. But what have you sort of, what advice would you give for Christmas time as a whole?
I think the thing with Christmas, obviously, for some people, it's a brilliant time of year and great if that's your experience. But for lots of people, that's not their experience. In fact, it's the time of year where they can have the worst mental health of their whole year is at that time, for lots of reasons. I think one of the issues with Christmas is... it's wrapped up in this ideology of good times and family and people getting together, and that energy is really positive and everybody's having this lovely, warm experience. And for some people, of course, that is the reality. Of course it is. But that's not the reality for lots of people. That's not how they feel at Christmas time, for lots of reasons. Maybe it's a reminder of the people who aren't alive anymore. So it's that massive hole where it feels like, well, you know, there's a huge sadness, because maybe, you know, all the family is together, but then somebody's missing. So that's a kind of a huge kind of reminder of all of that. But also, not every family gets on well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We talked about this the other day.
There's bad dynamics in some families and
a lot of families.
Yeah.
Loads.
So, if you think about it, if you've got those bad dynamics and kind of maybe people are avoiding each other throughout the year, and then you're going to shove them all together at Christmas time with booze.
When everyone
trust me for disaster. It really is. And so certainly for some of my patients, that's the thing they fear the most is, oh God, I have to spend time with my family, and how can I literally do damage control, which is, well, how can I walk into that space? And the thing is, the space is predictable because they know exactly who's going to be in that space, the problems with the relationships in that space. And yet, you know, you have to kind of pretend like I like you because it's Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, so it's a it's Oscar worthy performances, because it's really tough to be in those spaces. So for all of those reasons, it's really challenging. Mm. And the other thing as well, I suppose, too, is at Christmas time, like you say, the financial side of things. Again, it's that expectation, which as well, like, people have loads of money to spend on presents. They don't.
Yeah. No. They're worried about it's trying pressure. To live. And now you've got to get presents for 15, 16 people or whatever it is. It's just, I really want to talk more on this, because we talked about this on the ADHD Club. Mm. And I was just trying to find it then, the sort of table that Charlotte brought up. And it was, who's the radiators in your family? And I can't remember what the other word was, but who radiates like good energy? Who are you going to take good energy from? Mm. And who are you going to take that toxic energy from? And it was like, the best piece of advice she gave was, write down the people on the radiator, write down the people who are toxic, still can't remember the word, and find a way before it gets that Christmas time of just addressing that situation. So like you said before, like, I feel like last Christmas I spotted these patterns or whatever it is, and open that conversation. So when it's not closed off, when it gets to Christmas time, it's not the same argument again, or oh, are you still doing this? Or, and then it just, you get stressed out, and then because you're stressed out, your mum gets stressed out, and that vicious cycle, addressing them before Christmas. I thought that was such an interesting thing, and I'll try and find them. If I do, I'll put it in the show notes, because I thought that was one of the best things that she had taught me personally. I want to hear your view on that, and sort of addressing things before that Christmas time, because it can be just, it can be a bad day for a lot of people, especially Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, of this alcohol, as you said, financial stress. Everyone's massively overstimulated. Well, I know myself, I'm very overstimulated on Christmas Day. And it can be a recipe for disaster if you don't address things before.
We often put a plan of action in terms of, okay, well, so with the financial side, where we obviously don't look at budgets, but we look at spending within your means. And like, spending within your means is that you're not going to step outside of that, because again, the consequences of that are going to be, you know, big. So thinking consequentially of, okay, what can you afford, and also what feels like it's not going to burden you. So you're still getting involved with the present giving, but within your own means. The other thing too, around say the family piece, is we look, okay, what can you manage? So if you can only manage 4 hours there, then that's it. That is it. Because if the environment is toxic and hostile, and you know that the longer you're in there, the worse it gets, then you need to kind of think about, okay, well, what feels safe, but also what can I manage in terms of my exposure to that. So in some cases, it's putting those very hard boundaries in, which is, well, I'll see you at this time, but we're going to be going at this time. So it's very clear kind of what you're doing. The other thing in terms of plan of action too is to have an ally in the environment. So having somebody that you identify, where if things are really going difficult for you, then you identify that person and you go and speak to that person. So you tell that person beforehand, brother, sister, cousin, whatever, that I don't find it easy being in this space. So if I'm struggling, I'm going to come and find you. And then the person's like, yeah, okay, cool. Like, let's deal with this. So you've already forewarned them, but also you've got somebody in the space that you know has your back and also is able to kind of intervene on your behalf. One final thing I'd say as well on that is, when you're dealing with your family, families don't always respect your personal boundaries.
Yep.
It would be great if they did, but they don't. Not all of them. So if you know that, then you trying to push your boundary for the sake of accommodating them is only going to harm you. So if you put the hard boundary in and the family don't respect your boundary, then that doesn't mean your boundary is wrong. That just means your boundary is not being respected.
That's interesting.
I love that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I like so that. It's thinking of getting, and also like if you don't kind of initiate that, then you're going to be picking up the pieces. And I know even certainly when I come back to work in January, like these are the conversations I have. It's literally like how Christmas was a nightmare and my mother said this and she said this and my sister said this. And, you know, and the problem is it's all those old family dynamics come back and people regress. Like you're literally going back to being like kids again. But you're not kids, like you've all moved on, but all the old stuff comes back. And also some of the parents, like they play the kids off against each other. Like it's just toxic.
Yeah, it is.
Really toxic. Yeah. So it's recognizing all of that, like, it's your family, but what's in the air? Like what's in that space when you walk into it? It's not Christmas trees and mulled wine, it's all this other stuff sitting in the air too.
That leads perfectly onto this. Again, this is our favourite question always, and this will be the last question. It's what piece of advice would you give to men out there who are listening to this, going into that Christmas period? That was a great piece of advice before as well. Going into that Christmas period and knowing what you know, seeing people in your clinic, what piece of advice would you give to people to take away at Christmas time?
So, do you want me to address this one to men?
Or absolutely, I think we could do both.
Okay, so men. I have so many things to say about this, but I'm going to try and keep it succinct because I don't want to lose the opportunity here. You need to have a serious think about what kind of man you want to be. Because being a bloke is a concept. Being a bloke is an idea. There is not one specific type of guy. Mm. There's loads of different kinds of guys. And some guys are the guys that are scared of their mental health, or they feel it's weakness, or they feel that that's not what it is to be a man. But I really feel men need to kind of look at themselves and think, well, what kind of bloke am I? Like, am I that guy? Or am I the guy that actually takes his mental health seriously, thinks about how much he's drinking, thinks about the impact of my decisions on my lifestyle? Or am I going along with this idea of what I think it is to be a man? Because that to me is a huge issue, which is this idea of, well, this is what guys do. No, it isn't. No, it's not. Certain guys do that, yeah. But if we were to look at those guys, well, look at their life. It's a train wreck.
Yep.
So something's going wrong there. Something is going wrong. So really kind of thinking about am I understanding what I'm doing with my life when it comes to the lifestyle I lead, the choices I make, my focus, and do I understand what my idea of masculinity and being a bloke is? I have a massive bugbear with that.
I love that. That was amazing.